right, good morning. And a very special welcome to anyone who is visiting this morning. I know we have a lot of visitors traveling for the holidays, so welcome. And I would like to pass on my own personal tradition to you, which is whenever I visit a church, there's always a guest speaker, so you guys get me this morning. But as Scott mentioned, this is our traditional elder preaching spot. It's tough shoes to follow. Our preaching pastors do such a fantastic job week in and week out. There's tough shoes to follow, fill in, but it's a great opportunity for us elders to be able to get up here and share what's on our hearts with you all. Some of the elders, as you might know, are on staff, but most of us are not. As Scott mentioned, I am an engineer, a mechanical engineer by training. I've worked at startups, and I've worked at large companies here in Silicon Valley. So the triumphs and travails of living life here in Silicon Valley is a particular interest to me. And I thought that's something on my heart that I'd like to share with some of you. About the same time as I was thinking about what to share, I started reading through the reading plan that's in your pews on the life of passion. And on the back, appropriately, there's an elder section, and there's a list of psalms there. And one of the psalms that I read was Psalm 127. I believe the Lord led me to this psalm. And in the psalm, I think it addresses particular issues that we all face here in living life in Silicon Valley. What do we do with work? How do we raise our kids here? Is there a work-life balance? Is it achievable? And so one of the images we saw as I was preparing for this sermon was this image of a guy getting on a tightrope and just kind of picturing, wow, wouldn't it be nice to have work-life balance? But then thinking about this image and what does that really mean? And balance is tough. It's tough to get up there. It's tough to stay there. And more times than not, you fall, right? So these are all very much questions that I wonder about. And so hopefully this is a reflection of the Lord working through me this morning. So let's read Psalm 127 together. Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. What we see in Psalm 127 is that it addresses two of life's great worries, work and children. But if we find God in these things, we find something else. We find rest. And that rest ultimately comes from Jesus. Jesus gives us rest from our striving to make ourselves, our children, our work significant. Regardless of your stage of life, I think these topics speak to all of us. We all have work to do, whether we're students, we're starting our careers, we're in our midlife careers, just retired. We all have work to do. Likewise, we all have connections to children, either our own, our grandchildren, nephews, nieces, maybe we're preparing to have children. There's lives of children that you can touch here. Well, working in Silicon Valley for many people is much more than just work. It is the opportunity to change the world, to reshape it with the innovations. Our work is important to us. But we also know there's other parts of life that we struggle to keep them in perspective. We turn then our manic energies of work and then pour the manic energy into our kids. Titles like tiger moms, helicopter parents, these are all phrases that we use to describe the manic pace of parenting here in Silicon Valley. Just as passionate as we are to see our work succeed, we want to see our kids succeed as well. But in many cases, this just leads to more frustration, dizzying exhaustion, despair, and heartache in the worst of cases. Many of us talk about finding work-life balance. Perhaps that's your New Year's resolution. Kids, you might be wondering what this means. It might look like playing more video games than doing homework. Just a suggestion. If so, you're not alone. A recent New York Times article reported in a poll out of 4,040 respondents, mostly startup founders who are also parents. Out of those respondents, 63% said they struggled with balancing their startup and parental duties daily or all the time. Now, as one of those people, I'm frankly surprised the number is only 63%. I thought it'd be a lot more. But it speaks to that this challenge is real, that it's out in our world, that we're facing it and that others are facing it in our society. Likewise, the pressures of raising a family here is daunting. We all know about the economic challenges, trying to earn a living to be able to live in a house here. But parenting is also difficult. I remember bringing Josh, who's now 12, but back when we first took him to kindergarten as a five-year-old, in his first day. And I started chatting with some of the parents outside, and they started asking me with questions about, well, where'd you go to preschool, and what's he reading, and what kind of math is he doing? And I was, this is the first day of kindergarten, right? We're not talking college. And suddenly I felt like I'd failed him already as a kindergarten parent. And he hadn't even walked into class yet. So as parents, we fret and we worry about our children. So what do? We talk about being countercultural. We talk about being in the world, but not of it. But what does that mean? Do we work less hours, falling behind others as they burn the midnight oil? Do we let our kids fall behind, not pushing them to their full potential? Let me take a little step back and introduce Psalm 127. Again, I wanted to connect with our overall series of the Life of Passion, a study of David's life. So I was excited to see this psalm was included in our reading list. This psalm is one of 15 psalms described as the Psalm of Ascents. Now, you might remember a few years ago, we went through our study of Epic, and after that, we had a study actually on the Psalm of Ascents. And these psalms were sang and they were read and prayed through by the Israelites as they journeyed up to Jerusalem for three different festivals, annual festivals. These festivals were established to remind Israel of God's good works. So this morning, think of this psalm as your journey. Your journey changes from being a student to being a recent grad to maybe new married to starting a family. I found myself constantly reasking these questions, reevaluating these things before the Lord. The second thing I noticed as I was reading the psalm was it seemed like the psalm could be written in two separate psalms. There's this work portion, and then there's this children portion. And I was kind of wondering why God had put these things together. And oddly enough, God used Facebook to show me why. About a couple months ago, I was looking at Facebook, and then I noticed I'd gotten a friend request. And it turned out to be a friend from college, a college roommate that I hadn't spoken to in about 15 years. Well, how did I respond? How did I sum up my life? 15 years, what do you say? So I ended up writing about my work and my family, all in about six sentences, because that's all you can really write in Facebook Messenger. And so that showed me, these are things that are important to us. And in fact, one commentator I read suggested that this is exactly what those pilgrims were doing as they traveled to Jerusalem. They would get together, see folks they hadn't seen for a year, and talk about their work, talk about their children. And God would use this psalm to remind them, I'm the one that's giving you work. I'm the one that's blessing you with your children. Another interesting thing about this psalm is that in the Psalm of Ascents, this is the one that's attributed to Solomon writing, not to David. David's the author of the other psalms, and I think this is another great clue for understanding this psalm. Perhaps Solomon has in mind the work of building the temple here. As we'll see in our study in David in the upcoming months, David wanted to build a temple, a house for the Lord. But God is the one who reminds David and says, I'm the one that made you king. I'm going to build my house, and I'm going to use your son to do that. And more importantly, I'm going to establish my son as the king over your throne. And so it connects to this theme of Psalm 127. God builds the house. He establishes the security of the kingdom. He establishes his son. So I started studying this series wanting to know about how to follow Jesus and how it uniquely applied to Silicon Valley life. What I started to see was that, yes, Silicon Valley has unique challenges, but that these themes already have some ancient ties. We see this already in the Psalms, but we can go farther back and see how they're rooted in Genesis. And these are a couple of little cartoons that kind of explain how they get there. Let me sum up and make some observations from Genesis. First, we see that God works. God creates, he makes things good, and then he rests. But in that creation, God invites man into that work. He invites man to cultivate the good creation that God has made. Here we have the model for work. In the curse, however, we see that all things change. Work becomes increasingly difficult. God speaks to the role of giving birth and the pains being increased there. And surely that speaks to the actual act of childbirth, but you only have to go to the next chapter to see how difficult being a parent becomes in the story of Cain and Abel. I think we think of sin often as personal indiscretions, moral failings, things that we do wrong. But it's so much more than that. It takes the good things that God has made and twists them and makes them into something not good. So we see this happening in Genesis. We see that the good thing God had made in terms of work and family being twisted up in sin. And so it kind of explains why we find these topics difficult and challenging for us today. But this actually gave me great comfort to know that this isn't a one-off Silicon Valley problem, but that this is actually rooted in the very heart of our problem as man. And it gave me hope because the solution has already been started. It had started in Genesis, and God brought about that solution into reality in Jesus. So let's see how that's done. Let's look at the first two verses. These verses talk about what is wrong with work. Solomon highlights two things: building a house and a watchman looking over a city. They both follow a pattern of, unless the Lord does something, it is vain. A home is more personal. It affects a smaller number of people. Those who build it labor in vain. It speaks to a team, teamwork. Similarly, the watchman is an individual working. He's working towards our security, working towards something greater in the community, not just your family, but the whole city. And so in these two short verses, Solomon encompasses all of work. Things that we do individually, things that we do in a team, things that we do as a benefit to our family, things that we do to benefit our society as a whole. Unless the Lord is a key phrase here, and he repeats it twice. It frames the whole psalm to make us look at this psalm through God's perspective. It reminds us that God is sovereign. This means that he is completely in control. Success and failure, no matter how we measure it, it doesn't catch God off guard. This should be an incredibly comforting statement to us. The second point is clear also, that God invites us into this work. He still expects us to work. It doesn't say, unless the Lord does this, and then I can just relax. So that's not a pass, kids, for not studying, and God's going to give you an A. Not what that means. God is still inviting us into that work. God invited Adam into that work, and God is inviting us into that work that he's still doing. We've all probably heard warnings about putting work before God, making work an idol. I think that's an obvious warning. But then what's the alternative? Can we really invite God into our Silicon Valley lives, our Silicon Valley jobs? What does that look like? To answer that, I think we have to figure out what it means to be, what it is to mean, it is in vain. What does that mean? So let's look at the next verse. Verse 2 breaks from the unless the Lord, it is vain formula. In fact, he tells us exactly what it means to be vain. It is vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil. You see, vanity is that restlessness in our work that drives us to wake early and to rest late. I think we've all had that feeling that jolts us up in the middle of the night, wondering if we missed a deadline or we didn't do something or we had done something inadequately. I don't know, you college students, if you've had this dream yet, I had it several times of sleeping through a final or missing an alarm or being late to a final. I think I had that dream for several years after college. I think that sense of anxiousness followed me along. The work that is vain is the work that is done to cover our anxiousness. It's vain because we become self-absorbed. We start to do things to benefit others and not ourselves. We cover and protect ourselves instead of covering and protecting other people. And that usually leads to destructive paths of tearing down others instead of building them up. It is vain work because it is work that can never satisfy, because it seeks to build us up rather than to give glory to God. It is work done out of fear, out of pride, done to make our names great instead of the Lord's. So what's the solution? The antidote is found only in God, we see in the next part of the verse. For he gives to his beloved sleep. Wouldn't it be great if we could just rest? We could just sleep? God set the model for work, right? He worked, he created something good, he rested. And now he gives us that rest. We can find our rest in Jesus. Rest in the context of the gospel means we don't have to try to save ourselves, because frankly, we never could. Jesus has done that work for us. We don't have to try to cover our faults. We don't have to try to do things to make us look better. Jesus does all that for us. And that's absolutely true of our work as well. Remember, he says, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." We can rest because God is sovereign. Remember, unless God builds. That means we can rest in apparent successes and failures, promotions, demotions. It's not easy, but it is there for us. When we rest, we can find a renewed purpose that transcends vanity. Instead of striving for ourselves, we can work to bless others. One of the books I read in preparing for this sermon was one by Tim Keller called Every Good Endeavor. And Tim Keller argues that in that book, God allows all men made in his image to participate in the care for his creation by working in his creation and being productive. This one quote helped make it clear to me. The Christian faith gives us a new and rich conception of work as partnering with God in his love and care for the world. This biblical conception helps us appreciate all work, from the most simple to the most complex, by both believers and non-believers. So Christians who grasp a biblical theology of work learn not only to value and participate in the work of all people, but to also see ways to work distinctively as Christians. Imagine now that your secular job can actually be used to be a blessing to other people, not just in your immediate sphere, but as a society. Imagine that God has given you specific gifts and talents and training to be able to do just the task that you're doing. So that's why school is important and doing well there. This is, in fact, not vain, but it's godly. Is this how you approach your job? Is this how you approach school? I know that's not true in my case. For me, for far too long, I just looked at my job as something else, something that I did to pay the bills. I did not want to set my job up as my idol. Incorporating faith into work meant nothing more than trying to be a good testimony, which typically meant that I was trying to do acts of self-righteous good deeds to appear better than the next guy. But frankly, I fail at that too, right? I have not allowed myself to enjoy my job, to enjoy what God has blessed me to do, because, like I said, wouldn't that be selfish? Wouldn't that be idolatrous? But in fact, I think it's not. Most of us have said in this, in our attempt to find a work-life balance, we've said, we work to live, not live to work. But what if this isn't the paradigm at all? What if the paradigm is we live to bless others through our work? Do your work, the work God has given you. Do it well so that it blesses others. There's no vanity in this. And in this, we can celebrate with believers and non-believers alike who accomplish similarly good accomplishments. Remember, God made work and it was good. The gospel allows us to break from this curse, to make work less than it was, and allows God to put it in its proper perspective in its place again. The gospel's not about balance. I used to think the gospel was this balance between sin, where I just did whatever I wanted to please myself, and legalism, right, where I follow the rules so that I prove that I'm good enough. And in this fine line between these two spheres is the gospel, where I have to kind of walk that tightrope, and inevitably I fall off one side or the other. And I don't think that's what the gospel is at all. I think what Jesus does is he takes all those things and he changes it and transforms it and makes it into something completely different off of these two planes. And maybe that's why we find work-life balance so exhausting and so difficult to achieve, is because we're trying to walk a balance between two things that we really can't. Instead, our lives must be wholly transformed, and that includes our work. And that means surrendering it all to God, allowing him to build, and allowing him to give us rest. I think the world is beginning to realize this too, that the work-life balance is difficult and has its flaws. I found this article, again, while I was doing some research, and I actually like the title better than the quote, because it says, "Silicon Valley, Work-Life Balance is for Losers, Not Closers." It's an article in Forbes. But an entrepreneur, Mukund Mohan, wrote, "Some older entrepreneurs," and you might be offended by this, "usually over 35 years of age, will share their ability to strike a balance between work and life. Practically speaking," I hate to break this to them, that does not exist in a startup. If you have that balance, you are not serious enough about your startup. That's what this guy thinks. And increasingly, I think we'll all feel that pressure too at work. So which way do we choose? Do we follow his advice, his model? I think we should choose God's model. Choose God's rest that he has to offer. Offer up your work to be part of that transforming process. To quote Scott Grant just a few weeks ago, offer your life to God. He won't waste it. If you haven't listened to that sermon, go back and listen to that, because I think it speaks to many of the same points. A few years ago, the startup that I was at for nearly 7 years ran out of funding. I got to tell you, there's a little bit of bitterness in there, inside of me that sat there. And I would often tell Vanessa, you know, those were 7 wasted years. But were they really? I think God has used time to kind of show me there were things that were actually good about it. Now, the things that I chased perhaps were vain, as we talked about. The hope for success, the pride of achievement, those things won't be realized. But really, they never were going to be realized. But there were good things, and I think God has shown me that too. There were people who used our product. It was a medical device that had their lives profoundly changed by Christ, or profoundly changed. There were skills that have helped me in my new position, relationships that were built, lessons that better relationships could be built with a little bit more time, a little bit more care. So maybe some practical steps to offer to you this morning. Ask God to show you how your blessing can be, or how your job can be a blessing to society. Not just the people around you, but to society as a whole. How it contributes to the good of man. And I think this is different than just finding personal fulfillment in your job. This is other-centered. This is centered on building other people up, blessing other people. This is not me-centered. We speak about vocational ministry as being called to ministry. And I don't think it would be untrue to think about our jobs here in Silicon Valley, our lives here in Silicon Valley, as people who are called to be here. There are numerous examples in the Old Testament where God positioned people in specific positions to bless. Joseph, Ruth, Daniel, Nehemiah, Esther, to name a few. God used all of them in their positions to bless society. We bless others relationally, serve others. Again, you don't have to be, now if we're focused on others, covering ourselves with anxiousness and wondering if we're going to get what we've been chasing after. We can serve others. Be excellent at your work. Whatever job you find yourself at, be excellent in it as a blessing to others. Do your job as well as you can. Working is for the Lord. But don't chase the results. Let God worry about those results. He is sovereign. God won't waste your life. So it might mean also making some very difficult decisions. Should you stay at your job? Should you leave? Maybe you have the chance to influence how work is done in your workplace. And maybe some things need to change in order to bless others. Are there relationships that need to be repaired? Maybe relationships that need to be built. Many of you might be hoping I'd say, you need to work less hours. Trust me, I was hoping for that too. I don't think I can tell you that, though. I think that's something that we all have to wrestle with within the context of where God has us. And if we submit all that to God, he'll show us. But rest has nothing to do with just having more time on my hands doing nothing, much to my chagrin. It means not being anxious for the time that we have, allowing God to work through us to bless others, and allow us to bless us with whatever results he chooses to give us. God invites us into our work, and he gives us rest in Jesus. Moving on to verses 3 through 5, we get into the part about the children. And we've been talking about this chase for the work-life balance, and ironically, this life side of the equation can be just as exhausting. But I believe the concept of rest that we've been talking about still applies. Talk to any parent here in Silicon Valley, and I doubt rest is the first word that comes to mind. I remember when our children were young newborns, and getting an hour of sleep was awesome. And now that they're older, we're constantly driving from this activity to this activity. Where do we find rest? So let's read these verses. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb, a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. But again, this isn't the rest we're talking about. It's the anxiousness with which we fret over our children. Now, my mom has gotten a little bit better at this. I'm in my 40s. But if she heard my voice right now or me sniffling, she'd probably tell me to go to the doctor. She'd probably call me right now and say, hey, it's 30 degrees outside. Why don't you have a jacket on? The constant worry and concern over our children can be exhausting. Scott mentioned that in a few weeks we'll be at our pastor elder retreat. And again, one of the best parts of that time there is being able to come together and use those prayer cards you guys are writing and be able to pray over the congregation. But what struck me last year was the number of cards sent in by adult parents of adult kids and still praying for them. How do we find rest in all of that? In many cultures and times, the hope for a better future was directly tied to children. Perhaps even more so than the work that they themselves were doing, children were a source for something, for a better life, a hope for something better. This may not always be the case in Silicon Valley, where we're very affluent, but we still want something better for our kids. But in a world of overachievers, isn't that asking a lot of them? I think the answer is still the same. We find rest in God's Son, not on our children. And in a strange twist, God delights in us, his children. This is the message of the gospel, no matter our stage of life, that we are God's children and he delights in us. Now, the process of becoming a parent, I think, is training for us to rely on God being sovereign. And for some of you, the journey to become parents can be long and sometimes painful. Abraham and Sarah's story is one example in scriptures. I don't think I have any easy answers here at all, but I hope that as we read this psalm, there's not a sense that God is somehow denying a gift that he has given to others. Instead, I hope that we all see that we are all included as God's gift, as God's heritage, his inheritance. So let's look at the first verse, verse 3 again. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. And I think that word heritage is key in this translation. In other translations, the word instead of heritage is gift. While both words imply something freely given, gift has a sense of transference of ownership. In fact, we just did this a few days ago, right? Kids, who got a gift that said you have to give it back? Anybody? That wouldn't be a very good gift, right? But many of us gave gifts and expected the receivers to use it as as they wanted. Heritage, however, has a little bit different has a different connotation, and it has a connection back to the giver. It's the same word that's used in Hebrew to describe the land that's given to the Israelites. Each person, each tribe could possess the land and be blessed by it for a certain time. But it was known and understood that the land was still owned by the Lord, and it was through the land that people got to experience God's blessings by living and taking care of the land. I feel like my children are much the same way. I don't own my kids, but before the Lord, I'm responsible for their health, their well-being, to nurture them emotionally and spiritually. However, I'm learning that they are their own people as well. They don't do things the way that I do them, or maybe as I want them to do them. They don't see life as I do. They have their own experiences. But they're also not solely independent individuals. They're still shaped by the genetics they've inherited, behaviors that have been modeled by us, influenced by other people, you in the congregation, other family members, friends, teachers. But first and foremost, they are the Lord's, and He cares for them more than we can understand. In that, there's tremendous freedom, but it's still hard to let go. Recently, a former dean, Stanford dean, Julie Lithcott Hames, wrote about helicopter parents. Little illustration there. And these are parents that hover too closely over their kids, trying to protect them. It comes from a good place, right? You want to provide the best for them. Yet, what she found was it stunted some very basic areas of development. She actually lives in our community here in Palo Alto and has spoken on this topic and topics of teen suicide that we've had to face as a community. But one thing she wrote really, really got my eye. She said, "We expect them to be perfect at all of this, perfect in a way we never were." Clearly, this is not a healthy statement, and it continues to be something even kids in our church face. Isn't that a haunting statement? Let me read it again. "We expect them to be perfect at all of this, perfect in a way we never were." That's a burden no one can handle. Christ alone is perfect. So the question is, what do we want for our kids? A few months ago, I had the privilege of presenting three families up here for baby dedication, and we got to meet the families in a couple weeks before the actual service. And what was great to hear from them was their heart for their kids. They spoke of wanting to have their kids know the Lord. They spoke of them wanting to have their kids raised up in a community like this. But they spoke of their fears of the difficulty raising their kids here, of financial burdens, things that might tear their kids away. But I think that's what we all want for our kids and for ourselves, to be connected to our true heritage, to know that we're God's children, and to know that God is not ashamed of us. In fact, He delights in us. And so we see that in the Psalms. "He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate." Psalm 127 tells us, we can rest because we will not be put to shame because of our kids. Our children will, in fact, represent us well. But in what way? I think we'll be most proud of our kids when our Heavenly Father delights in them, and really delights in all of us. F.F. Bruce writes in his commentary on Ephesians, "We must not overlook the fact that his people constitute an inheritance for God, his own possession, in whom we will display to the universe the untold riches of his glory. We can scarcely realize what it must mean to God to see his purpose complete, to see creatures of his hand, sinners, redeemed by his grace, reflecting his own glory." You see, all of us who believe in Jesus are being made more and more into the image of God's Son. We don't have to anxiously worry about making our kids into our own image, into what we want them to be. We can trust that the Lord is making us all into his image, and that we're part of his heritage. So let me close with some practical suggestions here. Rest knowing that each of us has a heritage in the Lord, including our children, that he's making each one of us into the image of his Son. Find out more about what that means by reading the scriptures together as a family, praying together. Help the kids around you know that they are loved and forgiven. In our annual Sunday school teacher training that we have here at Children's Ministry, Rahul Parekh said something I found to be of great encouragement. Rahul has been faithful in our ministry, serving several years, teaching our kids here at PBC. And I'm going to paraphrase what he said, but it really came from a heart as him being a parent. And he didn't talk about, here's how the best way to keep kids' attention or the best way to communicate truth or how do you maintain discipline in a room. He talked about what he really wanted his own kids to know. And he said, I want my kids to know that there's always a way home. There's always a path for forgiveness, that no matter how bad things got, God could always rescue. God delights in us. He wants us to be part of his heritage. So to close, God builds with us in our work. He gives us rest. We are his children, his heritage. He's not ashamed of us.